Good morning. You can go ahead and open your Bibles to Joshua chapter 13. We'll get started there in just a moment. What we're wanting to accomplish in our three-year study of an overview of the Old Testament is to give those in this Sunday school class and the companion 1 second hour to give you a basic working knowledge and some tools and some skills so that as you're reading through the Old Testament, you'll have a good handle, a good feeling on where things are, how the different pieces of the Old Testament fit together with each other. And for that purpose, we want to share with you just what are the main themes of the Old Testament book. Now, the books we have studied thus far, when we've only studied five, are now Joshua 6, so this is easy. You might want to jot these down on your class notes. You might see these again someday from time to time. But just as you go through the Old Testament, the first book we came to was Genesis. And, of course, the theme of the book of Genesis was beginnings. Beginnings of nations, beginnings of the world, beginnings of sin, beginnings of salvation, beginnings of all the different themes of the Bible. The theme of the book of Genesis is beginnings. Then we came to Exodus. The theme of Exodus is redemption, or you could say deliverance. The theme to the book of Leviticus is holiness. Remember all the holiness chapters we went to, and particularly holiness in approaching a holy God. That was just the theme that kept coming back over and over again through the book of Leviticus. We came to Numbers, and Numbers was all about the wilderness wanderings. We had some laws and things thrown in there, but the main theme was wilderness wanderings. And then Deuteronomy. Rod took us through Deuteronomy in a day. And the theme of Deuteronomy was the second giving of the law, the second law. The last few weeks, 2 weeks and today, we have been studying Joshua. The theme of Joshua is conquering and dividing the land. As God acted to fulfill his promise made to Abraham. And we specifically saw how it related to, or the book of Hebrews related this to entering God's rest. For the Old Testament Hebrews, it was entering physical rest in a physical land. For us as believers, it's entering that rest of salvation where we have ceased striving to work to obtain our salvation. But the theme for Joshua is conquering and dividing the land. Now, over the next 2 years, we'd like to give you 8 key dates to remember to help you put together pieces of Bible history. And these are dates that Tom Pennington has shared with some men in a discipleship group that meets infrequently with him. But there's no reason for you to try to remember that the conquest happened, the time of the conquest happened about 1399 B.C., You're not going to be able to remember all the different dates. But it is very helpful to know about 8 dates. And if you can commit these 8 dates to memory over the next 2 years, then as you're going through the Old Testament, you'll be able to tie different things that you read to these 8 dates. Now, we're only going to share 2 of them with you this morning. So don't panic. But the first date that you need to try to commit to memory is 2166 B.C. That is the time of Abraham. That would, and of course, we put all the quibble language out there about approximate. We don't know for certain. You know, we can be off years on these, but it will give you a ballpark feeling for when these events happened. The call to Abraham went out probably about 2166 B.C., So if you can remember 2166 B.C., you'll know that's about the time of Abraham as you're reading through the Bible text. The second date that you need to try to commit to memory is 1446 B.C. That would be an estimated time for the Exodus from Egypt. Now, how can helping this date help you find other dates in the Bible? Well, we're studying Joshua this morning, aren't we? We know that after the nation of Israel left Egypt that they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. And we'll see from today's lesson that the conquest looks like it took about 7 years to do the conquest. So if they left Egypt in 1446 B.C., they started conquering the land probably about 1406 B.C., took 7 years, 1399 B.C. So by committing that one date to memory, or actually we've talked about two, if you can work to commit these two dates to memory, then this will help you as we're going through the text. And I don't know about you, but as I'm reading through the Bible text, I'm saying, okay, something happened 1400 B.C. Well, I'm thinking, what else was going on 1400 B.C.? What were the Greeks doing? What were the Chinese, the Egyptians? What were the Indians doing, you know, the Asiatic Indians doing in 1400 B.C.? If you have some dates in mind, it just helps you put into perspective the different events of the Bible. So, those are two dates to try to point, commit to memory. Well, let's start with our lesson this morning. Starting in Joshua chapter 13. If we back our memory up to Joshua chapter 1, we see that God told Joshua to be strong and courageous. He said to Joshua, "Be strong and courageous, for you shall give this people possession of the land which I swore to their fathers to give to them." God told Joshua, "You shall give this people possession of the land which I swore to their fathers to give to them." Although the conquest had been made, as we talked 2 weeks ago about entering the land, and then last week Gary talked about conquering the land, the conquest had been made, but the land has not been given. So Joshua's mission is not complete yet. His mission is not going to be complete until the land is given. If you look in Joshua chapter 13, the first thing we see in verse 1 is that Joshua is now old. He's not just old. God says he's old. And when God says you're old, you're old. But the Lord said to Joshua, "You're old." And not only, he was probably about 90 years old. The second thing we see is that not only is he old, but there's still a lot of land left to be conquered. And again, it's God saying there's a lot of land left to be conquered. We have to remember that God was giving to these people a developed land. He wasn't just giving them a wilderness. As we enjoy thinking of our nation's history, we had this, in many respects, an unspoiled wilderness unto which we could go and whose firm and passion stress a thoroughfare for freedom beat across the wilderness. And we carved a nation out of a wilderness. But not so with Israel. They had a developed country. They had infrastructure. And so they were going to take care of that. Or that's what God was giving them. God says, "I will give you great and splendid cities which you did not build. I'll give you houses full of good things which you did not fill, and hewn cisterns which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant." And also, we recall God's promise in Exodus 23 to the Israelites that he would not drive out the wicked Canaanites inhabiting the land in a single year, that the land wouldn't become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for them, but that God would drive the Canaanites out little by little until they became fruitful and took possession of the land. So Joshua is old, and there still remains a lot of land to be conquered. Whereas Joshua chapter 12 ended with a very impressive list of the kings that they had conquered, Joshua chapter 13 starts with a list of the work that is still left to do. And as we go through the following chapters, we're going to see the phrase repeated many times about the inheritance. They did not drive out the such and suchites who were living in the land. Just as a brief discretion, a brief digression. In Joshua, we see an excellent illustration of God's sovereignty coupled alongside of man's responsibility, for want of a better term, or man's activity, man's involvement, whatever term you would want to use there. Because only God could work to drive the inhabitants out of the land. But he didn't act until Israel got involved and were obedient to do what he told them to do. Was man involved in the driving out of the inhabitants? We'll ask the 36 men, the families of the 36 men who fell at Ai, if man was involved. Ask the families who stayed east of the Jordan while their fathers and their brothers and their sons went to fight for 7 years to take possession of the land. Ask any of the soldiers who fought for 7 years to take possession of the land whether or not man had a role to play, or that God used man in playing a role in conquering that land. Obviously, he did. The story is often told of a rancher who had worked real hard to develop this nice piece of land, and a preacher came out to visit with him, and they were having dinner, and the preacher commented, says, "My brother Taylor, you and God have certainly done a fine work on this piece of land." And the rancher said, "Well, preacher, you're right, but you should have seen it when God had it all by himself." So the point that we make is that there is that which only God can do, and he will. God will do that which only he can do, but there is also that which God requires for man to do. And he will not do that which he requires man to do, as he did here in the conquest of the land. And the illustration we often use, I think it was Jeff Bridges wrote in Pursuit of Holiness, of the farmer. You know, the farmer puts the seed out in the field, in the garden. Well, only God can cause that seed to germinate and come to life. The farmer can't do that. But God will do that which only God can do, but he will not do that he requires man to do, that which he requires the farmer to go out and do the work. So that's an illustration that we see in the book of Joshua of God doing the work, yet God requiring man to be obedient and to do what God said for him to do, and enabling him to do it as well. As we look at the inheritance in chapters 13 and following, it's important for us to note the order of the inheritance, the order in which it was given out. The first inheritance that's given is given east of the Jordan. Now, this backs up to an event that already happened with Moses. Moses gave this land, and it's interesting, the Bible almost always speaks of Moses giving this land. I'm not certain that it ever refers to God giving the land. There was one reference that I can come across of God giving this land, but it was a person speaking. I think it may have been Jephthah speaking in reference to God giving this land. But I don't know but I think the Bible never speaks directly of God giving this land. But it does speak of the land east of Jordan, which would be right over this land in here, as having been given to these tribes by Moses. And the sequence that it talks about, the land being given, talks about the land being given to here to Reuben, and then to Gad, and then to half the tribe of Manasseh. Apparently they had a lot of flocks, and this was good grazing land. They wanted to stay on the east side of the Jordan River. This river formed a boundary, and through the rest of the Old Testament, you need to kind of keep this in mind. This was a bit of a barrier and a division politically, physically, emotionally, theologically. There is always a stigma associated with these tribes on the east side of the Jordan River, and we're going to see that even in the text we're looking at this morning. We're going to see it happen through the book of Judges, but this is when this inheritance was given. East of the Jordan, Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh. Next, we come to the land being dispersed on the west side of the Jordan. And that starts in chapter 14. And the lands were divided by lot with Eleazar the priest and Joshua officiating the division. The first inheritance that's given is not to a tribe. Does anybody know the first piece of inheritance that's given? Just one. Not to a tribe, it's to an individual. Do you want to take a guess? Caleb. First piece of land goes to Caleb before it's given to any tribe. Caleb was one of the two scouts who came back with a favorable report saying, we can take this land, it's good land, it's powerful, but we can take it by God's grace. And God made promises to him, Moses made promises to him, and first thing that happens, Caleb gets his inheritance. He was a man of faith 45 years ago when he went and scouted out the land. He's still a man of faith on this day. And the chapter 14 tells us that his physical strength is unabated. 85 years old at least. It does give his age. 85 years old. His physical strength unabated. And he gets to ask for his land. And note in chapter 14 the type of land that he requests. Now, when God told Joshua to divide out the land, he specifically said, a lot of the land is unconquered. You include the unconquered territory in the inheritance that's being given out. Caleb asked for unconquered territory at age 85. And wind your mind back to Numbers chapter 13, when the other spies came back with an unfavorable report. They said, we can't take the land. What's the problem? What were the problems that they said they couldn't take it? The people were big. We saw the sons of Anak there. What was another reason they said they couldn't take it? Not only are the people big, the cities are fortified. Look, if you will, in Joshua chapter 14. What is the description of the land that Caleb asked for? He says, I want unconquered territory in the hill country, because it has the sons of Anak in there, and it has fortified cities. That's what I want for my inheritance. Wow. And then Joshua 14. And then he says, with his tongue in his cheek, perhaps the Lord will be with me, and I shall drive them out, as the Lord has spoken. What a man of faith. What a man of faith. At 85 years, after all these years of wandering in the wilderness and all these years of combat already, he remembers the promise that God made to him, and he wants his territory to be in the unconquered region. So, Caleb gets his inheritance first. It's actually called the town of Hebron. And it's just south of the Dead Sea, right about there. That's Hebron right there. Now, Caleb was of the tribe of Judah, and so God orchestrated this sovereignly before the lot was ever cast, that not only was Caleb going to get his inheritance first, it was going to be in his tribe's territory. It was going to be where Judah's lot was going to fall. So the first lot went to Judah, and they got this territory down here in the south. Now, when you were a child sitting in Sunday school or in church, you would probably flip to the back of your Bible and look at a map like this, very similar to this. And so all those times you've spent looking at this map, this is the time you're supposed to really get to look at the map. So make the most of it. This is the time. But the first lot went to Judah. And then, the next lot went to Ephraim, and it was this area here where we talked about Caleb's inheritance. And then the other half-tribe of Manasseh got their inheritance right in here. Ephraim got their inheritance, and we have a problem. We have a recurring problem with the tribe of Ephraim. They had this problem with pride. It keeps on popping up again and again throughout the Old Testament. They thought they were better than the other tribes. They misinterpreted one of the blessings that Jacob gave on his deathbed as he was blessing his 12 sons, they misinterpreted something that he said to indicate that when a king arose for the land of Israel, it was going to come from the tribe of Ephraim. Obviously, they were off base, were they not? But here was Joshua from their tribe. Lo and behold, we're right. Yep, we interpret this right. Here's the leader. God arose the leader. We're the best tribe. We're number one. They had this problem with pride, and we're going to see it. Just keep this in mind. It'll pop up several times as we go through the Old Testament survey. But it pops up here as they're getting their inheritance. They're saying, you know, we are a pretty good tribe here. We're pretty big. We're pretty numerous. You haven't given us enough of an inheritance. Well, that was a pretty bold statement. And so they go to cousin Joshua. Hey, this is a kinsman. You know, sure, we can get a little more territory here. And what Joshua tell him to do? He told him, hey, yeah, you're a numerous people. Go cut down some forests. Make some more cities for yourself. The concept of the inheritance was not so much based on square miles as on developed towns. That was the focus of the inheritance. So they wanted more land, more territory. Joshua told them, go work for it. Go get out there, cut down some trees. Application being, you want more blessing? Get out there, do a little more work. J. Vernon McGee was commenting on a young man in the ministry who was talking about one particular book in the Old Testament, and the young man says, you know, that's just such a dry book. I don't get much out of that particular book. Maybe he was talking about Leviticus. I don't know. And J. Vernon McGee's response to him was, well, the reason it's so dry is there just hasn't been any perspiration off your forehead hitting the pages. And so, you know, you get a little sweat off the brow hitting those pages. All of a sudden, that's all the moisture that it needs for that book to not be so dry. You want a little blessing? Put in the work. I often see, this is just Daryl Bennett's private observation, but and I love the people that God, every one of the people that God brings to Countryside Bible Church, but often we see people, and it's not just Countryside, it's every church. We see what I call, just me, this is me personally, I call them 3-year wonders. They'll show up, they'll be here for 3 years, they'll be at the meetings, they'll come real faithfully, just be about, you know, just about every meeting you have. And after about 3 years, they're gone to another church, and they'll say something like, well, you know, this just isn't meeting my needs. It's not meeting the needs of my family. Well, you know, it's not just about your needs. It's where can you be a service? Where can you plug in? Where can you work? You know, maybe if you're wanting more of a blessing, maybe the missing factor here is the fact that you need to plug in and get involved in a ministry somewhere at the church and get invested. So with the tribe of Ephraim, you want more blessing? Well, there's the forest. Go out there, get your axes out, get busy cutting it down, get yourself a bigger blessing. So we need to watch out for Ephraim's pride as we continue through the Old Testament. 7 more tribes, and I'm going to try to pick up because I do want us to have time to talk at the end of class. There are 7 tribes left without their inheritance yet, so a really big event happened in chapter 18. They all assembled at Shiloh. They set up the tent of the meeting, and they set out a committee of 21 men to go and draw up a list of 7 equitable territories that's going to be divided among the 7 tribes. Just like if you have 2 kids and 1 candy bar, and you cut it, you have one of them cut it in 2, and the other one gets to pick the 2 pieces. You know, you make sure they're equal, nice pieces, so that's what they did. They cut up 7 pieces and said, okay, now we're going to cast lots, so anybody's going to be happy with any of the 7 lots that you get. So they cast the lots, and the territories went to Benjamin, and you can see, if you have your maps, let's see, there's, I have to use 2 hands, Benjamin, and then Simeon came down here. Again, the focus, Simeon got put into Judah. The focus not being on square miles, but on towns. And so there were some towns that kind of fell within the geographic area of, that had been given to Judah that hadn't been assigned yet. So that's how Simeon got down here. Eventually, Simeon got absorbed into Judah. Their identity did. And you may recall back again with Jacob giving his blessing to his sons, he specifically talked about Levi and Simeon and the problem they had with anger, how they had gone and killed men in their anger, and how they had maimed their oxen in anger. And he said because of that anger, they would be dispersed throughout Israel. Well, this is how Simeon got dispersed throughout Judah, and then Levi, we'll see, they were dispersed throughout as the priestly tribe without an inheritance of land. So we have, Benjamin, Simeon, and then Zebulun is up in here, Issachar over here, Asher over here by the sea, and then Naphtali next to Asher, and finally, last and least, we have Dan. Much to say about Dan coming last and the problem they had conquering their territory. And we'll get into that as we go through the book of Judges and the remainder of the Old Testament and even the New. Much to say specifically about the tribe of Dan and their inability to take their inheritance. Well, after these tribes received their inheritance on the west side of the Jordan River, we again have an individual receiving his inheritance, and that would be Joshua. Joshua chapter 19, verse 49. When they finished apportioning the land for inheritance by its borders, the sons of Israel gave an inheritance in their midst to Joshua the son of Nun. In accordance with the command of the Lord, they gave him the city for which he asked, Timnath-Serah, in the hill country of Ephraim. So he built a city and settled in it. No big deal made about it. He did his duty. He completed his task, and it was given to him by God, and then he went and lived on the land God gave him until he died. And he went to a city that was not made with hands. We have to notice how God bracketed this inheritance to the tribes with the inheritance that he gave to his two faithful spies, Caleb and Joshua. Just cannot get around his love and his provision there as he did that. The next inheritance that is given is to the cities of refuge. We've talked about the concept of cities of refuge in this class in the past. That's how they were distributed in the land. So you can see there were three on the east side of the Jordan River and three on the west so that people could flee there readily if they accidentally killed a person, and they would be safe in those cities and could not be put to death for an accidental slaying. And after the cities of refuge, then we have the account where the towns were given for the Levites. And as Tom Pennington spoke in his sermon, one or two Sundays ago, the Levites did not get land as an inheritance. God was their inheritance. So they did get some towns or some designated for them to live in, and presumably some houses in that town, in those towns, but land was not part of their inheritance. The Lord himself was their inheritance. So that's the sequence of the inheritance. That's dividing the land. Let's talk about keeping the land. The book of Joshua closes with two stirring charges that were delivered by Joshua. And we're going to take a look at this as we close the book. The first of the two charges happens in chapter 23. Verse 23:1 gives us the setting and lets us know that many years had passed since the land was apportioned out following the initial conquest. Joshua is even older now. He's approaching 110 years old. And he summoned the leadership of Israel, the elders, the leaders, the judges and officers, presumably to his home in Timnath-Serah, to deliver to them this message of utmost importance. Consider the motive that must have been driving this elder shepherd of Israel. He had been retired from active leadership 20, 30 years, something like that. Yet still very much his passion was to shepherd the nation Israel. And as he saw his own death approaching and events going on in Israel, there was a message that was burning on his heart that he had to deliver to the leaders. This is not just Old Testament filler here in chapter 23. This is a big, big deal. What did Joshua tell these leaders as he was approaching his death? Well, the key points of his message, he wanted them to remember that God had done everything that God promised to do for them. Verse 3 of chapter 23, "And you have seen all that the Lord your God has done to all these nations because of you. For the Lord your God is He who has been fighting for you." God's been the one doing the fighting. The next key point of the message, not only has God done what He's promised, but God is going to enable them to finish the task of conquering the land. It wasn't finished yet. Verses 4 and 5. "See, I have apportioned to you these nations which remain as an inheritance for your tribes, with all the nations which I have cut off from the Jordan even to the great sea toward the setting of the sun. And the Lord your God, He shall thrust them out from before you and drive them out from before you, and you shall possess their land just as the Lord your God promised you." So the third, which brings him to his third point, which is to be firm in the Lord, be firm to the Lord. Verse 6. "Be very firm then, to keep and to do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses." Does these words sound familiar to you? Can you what do they remind you of, Kim? In Deuteronomy, okay. Reminds you of a passage in Deuteronomy, that's good. Does it remind anyone else of another passage? Maybe one we studied about 2 weeks ago. This is... Did you have another answer? Okay. I'm sorry. It's what God said to Joshua back in Joshua 1. These words are very similar to what God said to Joshua back in 30-some years ago in Joshua 1. Do you think maybe he thought about these words from time to time? I mean, God told him to think about these words or the book of the law every day and to meditate on them day and night, and then he would have success. Do you think maybe Joshua did that? Look at what he's saying here to these leaders now, 30 years later. He's saying, "Be very firm then to keep and to do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, so that you may not turn aside from it to the right hand or to the left." That's from Joshua 1. "In order that you may not associate with these nations," Joshua 1, "these which remain among you or mention the name of their gods or make anyone swear by them or serve them or bow down to them, but you are to cling to the Lord your God as you have done this day." So God's done what He promised to do. He's going to enable them to finish the task of conquering the land. They are to be firm in the Lord and firm to the Lord. But just as God was faithful to do the good that He promised, He would also be faithful to punish them if they disobeyed. That's the other side of the coin. Verse 14, "You know in your hearts and in all your souls that not one word of all the good words which the Lord your God spoke concerning you has failed." Don't run past that. Let's say that again. "You know in your hearts and in your souls that not one word of all the good words which the Lord your God has spoke concerning you has failed." Every single good word came to pass. "All have been fulfilled for you. Not one of them has failed. And it shall come about that just as all the good words which the Lord your God spoke to you have come upon you, so the Lord will bring upon you all the threats until He has destroyed you from this good land which the Lord your God has given you. When you transgress the covenant of the Lord your God which He commanded you and go and serve other gods and bow down to them, then the anger of the Lord will burn against you and you shall perish quickly from off the good land which He has given you." Wow, what a sobering message that must have been to those leaders. That there was still work to do. God was going to enable them to do it. But if they were not obedient, just as God was faithful to do good, God would be faithful to do the bad. Application for us is the same as ancient Israel. We can live in this age of grace and we can look and we can see God's faithfulness and extending mercy. Yet we have to know that just as God was faithful to do what He promised that we call good, He will be faithful to do what He promised that we would call bad. So enough said on that. The next message that he gives in keeping the land is in Joshua 24. This instance, he calls all the nation together. Obviously, it would be like a holy convocation, like Passover or sometime like that, when the majority of the population would gather at one location. And the place that he chose for them to gather was Shechem. Why Shechem? Why would he ask them to gather at Shechem? What's the significance there? A lot of things happen at Shechem, Carol. Tell me some of them. Can't pull what? Yeah. like the birthday card my sister gave me. It said, for your birthday, I just want you to remember one thing. Go ahead. One thing. Anything. Can be anything. Just remember one thing. So, can you remember, anybody remember just one thing about Shechem? Well, yes, there was something to do with the law at Shechem. We talked about Shechem 2 weeks ago. Some big event happened at Shechem as they entered the land. Haven't got to Dinah yet. The number one thing that happened at Shechem was that as Abraham was traveling, he left Ur of Chaldees and he kept on wandering. God kept on saying, I'm going to show you a land, I'm going to give you a land, I'm going to give you a land. It was when he got to Shechem that God said, Abraham, this is the land that I'm going to give you. Now, as Israel came and left from the land, they would seem to always pass through Shechem. Jacob, when he went to Padan Aram, he left through Shechem. When he came back, he came through Shechem. Joseph, when he went to Egypt, he went through Shechem on his way out. But the point I was getting to is that in Joshua, the book of Joshua, chapter 8, I think it was, when they got back into the land, the nation was supposed to get to Shechem as quickly as they could. And Moses had commanded them to put half the tribes on a mountain on one side of Shechem called Mount Ebal, and the other half the tribes on the other side of Shechem on a mountain called Mount Gerizim, and they were to pronounce all the law, the blessings and the curses, there at Shechem. And it was as if they were saying, this is where God told us our land was going to be. We're here now. We are here, and God is fulfilling His promise. So we are here at Shechem in fulfillment of that promise that God made in Abraham, or made to Abraham back in the book of Genesis. So as Joshua calls for this convocation, he says, we're going to go back to Shechem. We did the law there at Shechem in chapter 8, and now here in chapter 24, 30 years later, we're going to go back to Shechem. So these people are going to remember the events that they did at Shechem 30 years ago, as he calls them now, and apparently the tabernacle is there, they're in the before the presence of the Lord. And once the nation is assembled, he calls the representatives of the people to come and meet with him. And the book of Joshua, you know, I love chapter 1 because of the stirring message that's given there, and yet it closes. You have that stirring message in chapter 1, and now it closes with an equally stirring challenge in chapter 24. And here's the message that Joshua gives. Now, the whole nation is there, and he calls representatives to come meet with him from the nation. He gives them a history lesson that's recounting God's faithfulness in verses 2 to 13. And in that history lesson, there's a reminder of all the false gods to which they've been exposed throughout their nation's history, starting with the false gods back in Ur of the Chaldees, and then the false gods that they got exposed to while they were down in Egypt. And then he brings in the false gods of the Canaanites in the land where they are right now. So he says, God's been faithful to do all these things to you. You've been exposed to all of these false gods. And then we have that most stirring passage in verse 14 where he says, now there, he tells them to get rid of the foreign gods and serve the Lord. He says, now therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in truth. And put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. And if it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves today whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served, which were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Well, the people respond. They said, Joshua told them whom they were going to serve, what God, and the people said, Joshua, we're going to serve the Lord. Joshua answers them in verses 19 and 20 says, you can't serve the Lord. The Lord's holy. You can't serve Him. And the people says, but Joshua, we will serve the Lord. And Joshua's response, well then, let your actions meet your words. Put away these foreign gods and serve Him and Him alone. Five times the people affirm that they are going to serve the Lord. If you look through the passage, and Joshua's response is, well then, if you're going to serve Him, your actions need to match it. Well, thus ends the book of Joshua. And Joshua sends the people back to their homes. He dies. He's buried. The bones of Joseph are buried between his two sons, Ephraim, the inheritances of Ephraim and Manasseh. And then Eleazar the priest, Aaron's son, dies and is buried. So the stage is now set for the book of Judges. We talked that these closing chapters of Joshua, the theme seems to be faithful to the end. And I asked the question on your notes, just who is it that's being faithful to the end? So I'm going to open it for questions. Now, there are three answers to who's faithful to the end. And let's save the most important answer for last. But can you think chronologically of the people that we have discussed? Who was the first one that we saw this morning that was faithful to the end? Caleb. We saw Caleb being faithful to the end. Who is another person that was faithful to the end? Joshua. Obviously, Caleb and Joshua, faithful to the end. So many of our Old Testament heroes don't end well. We love it when we see them do finish well, and that's what both Joshua and Caleb did. But above all, God. God was faithful to the end. As 23:14 said, you know in your hearts and in all your souls that not one word of all the good words which the Lord your God spoke concerning you has failed. All has been fulfilled for you. Not one of them has failed. He was faithful to provide His promise to Israel. He's faithful to do what He's promised for us today. We think of passages like 1 Thessalonians 5:23, where Paul writes, he says, may God Himself, the God of peace, sanctify you through and through. May your whole spirit, soul, and body be kept blameless at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. And then he closes with, the one who calls you is faithful. He will do it. We think of Philippians chapter 1, verse 6, where Paul says, I am confident of this very thing, that he who began a good work in you will perfect it until the day of Jesus Christ.